Thanks for inviting me into your home, your long-haul truck, RV camper, taxi, your parents' basement, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett, and tonight, this morning, we're coming to you live from Coast's Toronto affiliate talk radio, AM 640. Back in early November 2000, an online user by the name of Time Traveler underscore zero on the Time Travel Institute forum began a thread in which he claimed he was from the year 2036, and he began answering users' questions. The user later revealed his name to be John Teeter, and in his postings, he stated that he was an American soldier from the year 2036, as I said, based in Tampa, Florida, assigned to an undercover secret government project to go back in time to the year 1975, where he was tasked with the mission of locating and retrieving an IBM 5100 computer. He then stopped off at the year 2000 for undisclosed personal reasons. While in the year 2000, he sent off a couple of faxes to the one and only Art Bell here on Coast to Coast, and they were read out on the air. Later, a woman claiming to be John Teeter's mother, Kay Teeter, was later interviewed by our very own George Norrie. Teeter disappeared as quickly as he had appeared on the online forums, never to be heard from again. But the legend lives on. In hour one of the program, we'll delve into the legend of John Teeter and try to discover who may have been behind it. This is, of course, assuming John Teeter was not a time traveler, as he alleged, and that the entire brief yet captivating episode was or is a hoax. Mike Sove is a Toronto-based writer-researcher, and he's standing by to reveal who authored the John Teeter legend. The final 3 hours of Coast. Don Jeffries is back with a brand-new book. You may recall last summer I interviewed Don when his book Hidden History came out. That book was notable for a couple of reasons. First and foremost, because Jeffries is an excellent writer and researcher. And secondly, because Jeffries' work caught the attention of political operative Roger Stone, who wrote the foreword. Well, Don has a new book out that shines a sanitizing light on the almost inconceivable economic inequality in America. His latest, Survival of the Richest, How the Corruption of the Marketplace and the Disparity of Wealth Created the Greatest Conspiracy of All, is another good one. Jeffries will be here for 3 hours to detail how the collective wealth of America has been channeled from the poor and middle class into the hands of a few elitists, thanks to disastrous trade deals, outsourcing, and the crippling of unions. American industry has been gutted, with wages and benefits stagnant or reduced. Meanwhile, unimaginable salaries and bonuses for the 1%, contrasted by layoffs and reduced pay for the majority of the workforce, along with the increasing calls for austerity measures and lower standards of living, has become the new normal in America. Check out these bleak statistics Jeffries cites in the introduction. 76% of Americans are now officially living paycheck to paycheck. 76%. 62% of Americans have less than $1,000 in savings. That's pretty dire. And here's another one for you to chew on. After adjusting for inflation, 90% of Americans were earning less than what minimum wage earners made in 1950. Let me repeat that. After adjusting for inflation, 90% of Americans were earning less than what minimum wage earners made in 1950. 20% of American households have nobody working, according to the Bureau of Labor. The U.S. Census Bureau tells us more than 146 million Americans are either poor or low income. The wealthiest 1% of Americans presently has more wealth than the bottom 90% combined. Jeffries argues that this record economic inequality is more than an unintended consequence of globalism, and he'll be along to explain how the consolidation of wealth may well prove to be the greatest conspiracy of all. The Legend of Time Traveler John Teeter, and Economic Inequality in America, coming your way. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett. This is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? I know many of you listening to Coast tonight were probably listening back in January 2001 when Art Bell read from a fax he had received from a man claiming to be a time traveler from the year 2036, going by the name of John Teeter. Later, you may have heard George Norrie interview Kay Teeter, a woman claiming to be John Teeter's mother. Teeter made a number of predictions in his posts on the Time Travel Institute forum. A number of those came true, but a good number did not. Yet, the legend continues to fascinate people around the world to this day. Let's just assume for a moment that John Teeter was not who he said he was. He was not an American soldier based in Tampa, Florida, who traveled back to 1975 to retrieve an IBM 5100, a computer relic that was needed for some reason in 2036. Assuming that's not true, then who was behind the John Teeter legend? And what possible motive did they have? Here to discuss for the hour is Mike Sauvay. Mike has written nonfiction for the National Post, Variety, Exclaim magazine, and HTML Giant. His fiction has appeared in McSweeney's and elsewhere. His novels include The Wraith of Skrellman and The Apocalypse of Lloyd. They're available from Montag Press. He has extensively studied the John Teeter legend, and his latest book is titled Who Authored the John Teeter Legend? Mike Sauvay, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
Good, Richard. Nice to talk to you again.
Likewise. There are undoubtedly a few Coast to Coast listeners not familiar with the John Teeter legend, perhaps too young to go back to 2001. So give us an overview of the John Teeter story, how it began.
Yeah, I think you did a good job in your introduction. Claimed he was from the year 2036, went back to 1975. The reason was the IBM 5100, he claimed, had a unique capability to translate between APL, Unix, and APL, Unix, and BASIC.
BASIC?
Yeah. And so he was able to, and what he claimed is that because the time travel that John describes isn't like what we see in Back to the Future, where you go and you make a difference and then you go back to your timeline and that difference has been manifested. He's operating under the many worlds interpretation, where every time you go back into the past, you're going to a different world line. So he said the only real purpose of time travel was to retrieve artifacts. So in this case, the IBM 5100. And what's so interesting about the IBM 5100 is what John was describing, that ability to translate between those languages, was something that only, according to Oliver Williams, only 20 people who worked for IBM knew at the time, because they didn't want to market that because it would have hurt sales. If people knew that it was capable of doing all this, they would have been able to buy one computer instead of two. So not many people knew this. So there's your first sort of kernel of authenticity. If the John Teeter legend is fiction, if it's made up, then whoever came up with the story was in possession of this rarefied information.
You mentioned Oliver Williams. We should point out he's the editor for the time travel story of John Teeter, the website.
Yeah, he's the webmaster of the johnteeter.com website, and he done a lot of archival work. He at the time, you know, in the years following John's departure, these posts were spread all over the internet. They were hard to find. So Oliver Williams put them all in one place. He's been on Coast many times. He's a very informed voice on the subject.
So let's just go back to the beginning. He starts posting around November, early November of 2000. And how did that play out? What was the content of those early posts?
Right. So he was posting on the Time Travel Institute and also Art Bell's post-to-post message board. And the post had a lot of details about the physics of time travel, so much so that a lot of people theorize that whoever is responsible for these posts, if it's not a time traveler, is someone with a fairly serious physics background. And the people interacting with them, if you think about the internet back at that time, it was a little more of an effort to go on to a message board like that. A lot of people were still connecting via dial-up. So these people were not just, you know, someone listlessly scrolling through Facebook. They were actually asking some very informed questions, not only about the physics of time travel, but also about the philosophy of time travel, what John's world was like in 2036. So the discussion is characterized by a very high level of discourse, and I think that's why the story remains so valuable, because you can read it and draw a lot out of it. It's not just something slapped together.
And the fact that he was answering many of these questions in real time, in other words,
yeah,
he didn't have time to, you know, consult his encyclopedias or even go online necessarily to answer these questions. So it seemed like there was a degree of authenticity to his knowledge.
Yes, agreed. And he also, he would participate in messenger chats as well sometimes. So that was like absolute real time where, you know, the only thing we have access to those, and the only thing that really suffers is his spelling. He's just as sharp, you know, on Messenger as he is, because there are some theories that maybe some of the people interacting with John may have been plants, and that's why he's able to respond so intelligently so quickly, because he may have known some of these questions in advance.
Right, right. Well, we'll get into sort of unraveling whether or not, you know, this was a hoax. Let me ask you personally, I'm gathering that you maybe were too young to have maybe heard it live when Art Bell was reading these faxes from John Titor, you know, back in early 2001. So how did you first learn about John Titor?
Yeah, I would have been about 17 at the time, so I wasn't paying attention to it. But I was just one of those nights, you know, I've always been interested in all the subjects that you cover here on Coast, but time travel in particular. I remember as a really young kid just being blown away by film 12 Monkeys, and I've always been into time travel, and it was just one of those nights that I'm sure many of your listeners have here, where it's just 2 a.m., 3 a.m., and you're just clicking, and the things that are coming up on YouTube are getting a little bit stranger and a little bit stranger, but, you know, it's exciting and it's interesting. And it was actually a Coast to Coast George Norrie broadcast. It was the first time I heard about John Titor, and I remember as he was telling the story, I was Googling this stuff and I was reading, and I remember getting this just kind of shiver of recognition, not sure if he really was a time traveler, but knowing that there was a lot of meat on the bone here, that this was a really, you know, there's so much out there in the, you know, Freudian realm that's kind of flimsy, or you, the harder you look into it, that you can sort of see how, you know, you can probably dismiss it. And then it just seemed like there was so much to this that it wasn't going to go away. And I just never kind of stopped being interested in it. And it's just like many people on the Facebook groups and the message boards that still discuss it today, you love the story, and then you might forget about it for a while, and, you know, you're not living your whole life as a John Titor obsessive, but then something new happens, right? There's some new development in the story, and then we all come together to discuss it, and it's kind of got its own little thriving subculture around it.
And it continues to live online to this day. There remains online a sizable John Titor community, which is remarkable. We should point out that you don't dismiss the John Titor legend as a hoax. I mean, you went into this research very open-minded. Is that fair to say?
I kind of see the role of the book as presenting all the evidence regarding the potential authors in a neutral fashion, so that readers can make up their own mind. There's two other figures who are sort of John Titor commentators, and they have diametrically opposing views. There's one guy, Temporal Recon, who believes he's proven without a shadow of a doubt with his book, Conviction of a Time Traveler, that John Titor was real. There's another guy, his name is Rasmus, or the Hoax Hunter, and he believes he's proven without a shadow of a doubt that the lawyers are the lawyer Larry Haber and his brothers are involved. And I want to be somewhere in the middle. I want to leave both those possibilities open, but I just want to, because I think when you commit too firmly to one of those positions, then there's too much that doesn't reconcile. That's what's so strange about this, is that, you know, there's kind of like an if A, then B, but if A, not B, and it's very hard to, as soon as you commit to one position, there's things that quickly refute it. So I thought the best service my book could offer would be to just collect the evidence and make it available for people to read and make up their own mind.
The description of the time travel device that Teeter claimed he used, he writes in one of his posts, "My time machine is a stationary mass temporal displacement unit manufactured by General Electric. The unit is powered by two topspin dual positive singularities that produce a standard offset Tipler sinusoid." I mean, that, I don't know. That's either BS baffles brains or this guy knows what he's on about. I mean, has anyone sort of tried to pull this? I mean, he's published draftman quality drawings of this device. Has anyone ever looked at this and said, "Well, this makes no sense. It's just baloney," or there might be some merit to it?
Well, what's interesting is that at the time, John was talking about, when he talks about mini black holes, and he was talking about mini black holes being developed at CERN. And at the time, very few people were talking about CERN, and people were actually dismissing him at the time of the post for one reason or another. But in fact, as time has passed, our recent history has borne out a lot of what John says. So what people weren't saying at the time is now somewhat mainstream science. So, and there's a lot of examples of this. There's one point where John describes something. This is one of the more fascinating predictions. He describes Stephen Hawking's view on black holes, and somebody corrects him. And they said, "No, that's not Stephen Hawking's position on black holes." And then John says, "Oh, no, Stephen Hawking will reverse that." And Stephen Hawking did reverse his position on black holes and whether or not they emit radiation. So there's a lot of examples like that where time passing has actually borne out some of what John said. Now, if you were on the cutting edge of science, you could probably prognosticate that these things were going to occur. But again, I just think it's really interesting that rather than, you know, history passing and invalidating him, in a lot of cases, it's instead validated him.
Yeah, he had a few remarkable hits in terms of his predictions. The one that you just cited, I wasn't aware of. The other one, and you can tell me where and when this took place, but he talked about, and this was either in early 2000 or before, he mentions two towers missing in New York.
That's actually in the one of the faxes to Art Bell, and I believe, well, Art may have read it later. It was actually sent in 1998, and the exact phrase is that there's a building missing, or sorry, there's a building that hasn't been built in New York. And sometimes gets misquoted as there's a building missing, but he says there's a building that hasn't been built in New York. Now, I don't know. I mean, it could be that just, you know, with the advantage of, you know, looking at it in retrospect, that jumps off the page at us. But it could just be idle speculation. But at the same time, it's very striking. You can't read that fact to Art Bell and not, you know, that. And I believe it's even its own, that one sentence is its own paragraph, and it's kind of non-contextual within the flow of what he's writing. So that's a real eye-opener.
Mike Solvay is a Toronto-based writer, researcher, and his book is Who Authored the John Teeter Legend? Here on Coast to Coast AM. Of course, the one that he totally missed was he predicted a world war in 2015, and he said this would kill nearly 3 billion people. This was something he posted November 4th, 2000. Now, can these misses be excused by the many worlds theory of time travel?
That's kind of the out he gives himself, and it's why the more skeptical people or debunkers will just dismiss the whole story out of hand. But he did claim that with time travel, there's something called divergence. And the further back you go in time, the larger the divergence was. So he said that the divergence on our world line when he was visiting us was between 1% and 2%. So it would just stand to reason that some things weren't going to be right. There's also the idea that he did something in 1975 that changed the course of our timeline. And one of his most shiver-inducing posts, I believe it's either his last or his second last post, is he says, he wonders why none of us wonder why Y2K never happened, because at the time we were all so concerned about Y2K, and then it just kind of went away. So he's kind of implying that he's done something to alter our timeline.
Aha. All right. Well, he made a number of other predictions that didn't pan out. One, of course, was that the Olympics would be banned for the foreseeable future. That didn't happen. But again, maybe we have to cut him some slack because of his many worlds theory of time travel. We will continue to unravel the legend of John Titor with Mike Sauvé. On the other side, here's Rufus Thomas taking us into the break with Memphis Train here on Coast to Coast AM. And that's Van Morrison, I'm Not Feeling It Anymore, from his 1991 double CD, Hymns to the Silence. Who puts out double CDs anymore? Not too many. Just a reminder, coming up at the top of the hour, Donald Jeffries, and we'll discuss his latest, Survival of the Richest, how the corruption of the marketplace and the disparity of wealth created the greatest conspiracy of all. Mike Sauvé stays with us as we continue to unravel the John Titor legend. A crash between two young stars in the Orion constellation sparked a stellar fireworks display as giant streamers of dust and gas were sent into the interstellar space at 335,540 miles per hour. The cataclysmic event was captured by the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array telescope in northern Chile. The dramatic collision, which released as much energy as our sun emits in 10 million years, could help scientists understand the turbulent beginnings of stars in our galaxy. Our webmaster tonight, Lex Lonehood, has posted that story up at the coasttocoastam.com website, and you can read more about stars colliding in the highlight section. I want to mention that George Norrie is coming to Toronto, not far from where I'm sitting, in a couple of weeks, April 22nd to be exact. He'll be appearing at the Total Health Show at the Metro Convention Center here in Toronto. He'll moderate a panel discussion on Saturday, April the 22nd, from noon until 2 p.m. And then from 6 to 8, George will give a presentation on health and the environment, followed by a meet and greet. For tickets and more information, just go to coasttocoastam.com. And there in the menu up at the top, you'll see George Norrie's events. And he's got a bunch of them coming up, and I'll give you details on some more of those as the evening progresses. When we come back, your questions and comments for Mike Sauvé, author of Who Authored the John Titor Legend, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett, coming to you live from Coast's Toronto Affiliate Talk Radio, AM 640, and Mike Sauvé stays with us, the author of Who Authored the John Titor Legend. Now, you're very careful not to call this a hoax. It's an interesting sort of sociological or psychological aspect of this whole story, how something like this, the John Titor story, can take off and sustain itself, and it began online. I can't think of an example readily of a story that was, or a legend that was born online, that has lasted so long, that sort of predates the John Titor story. Can you think of one, Mike?
No, not really. I mean, certainly not one that's as significant. I think the reason is some of the elements of the story are the type of things that are enjoyed in the sort of conspiratorial circles. Like, for example, John talks a lot about the Constitution and the government coming for your guns, and these are, so he's kind of preaching to the choir. But he also has some sense of the scope of history, because he's talking about one of the elements of his future is that there's a nuclear attack from Russia and a United States civil war between essentially Democrats and Republicans. And it's interesting when you go back and listen to
that will never
interviews. Yeah, exactly. You go back and listen to old interviews, 2004, 2008, they're like, oh, this is the Civil War. This is the Civil War he's talking about. And with each passing, maybe presidential term, we just seem closer and closer to it. So I feel like the aspects of the story, we can kind of, it's almost kind of like a, reflecting mirror, where we can look and we can see ourselves in what he's saying. So it continues to seem relevant.
He also talked about deception over weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East.
Yeah, he did. He said, what was the exact term? It was, I have it here. Are you really surprised to find out that Iraq has nukes now, or is that just BS to whip everyone up into accepting the next war? And this was during the lead up to the Iraq war, when you were just starting to hear that, you know, the weapons inspectors were wanting to go in. And so he seemed to have some. Now, again, maybe this is just a good futurist who can sort of see where that's headed. Or maybe the classic caveat I always keep throwing out, maybe it was real time travel.
All right, let's take some calls before we get into some of the possible suspects of who may have been behind the John Teeter legend. We'll begin with the wild card line, and Gordon is in Lakeland, Florida. Hello, Gordon.
Thank you, Richard, for taking my call. Michael, whenever you were discussing the mini world theory, I wanted to find out if this was his explanation to the time travel paradox. The time travel paradox states that given enough time, given enough opportunities, eventually someone in the future would travel back in the very beginning and destroy it. So how can we even be here in the first place? I'm thinking that that was his explanation to how we could get out of the time travel paradox and still be here. There would be another world. And the second thing is, I just wanted to comment and make an official statement, and then I'll take both of my answers off air, or I'll hang on. The Klingon High Council disavows any time travel into your time past to mess with the presidential election. And as an official representative, I just wanted to pass this along to you guys.
Yeah,
so
appreciate
I'll hang
that.
On
Thank
if you,
you
have any questions. I think I'll hang on instead of be off air. But I think they're pretty straightforward questions, so I'll just listen.
All right. Thanks for that, Gordon. All right, Mike, did you get the gist of that?
Thanks, Gordon. Essentially, with the many worlds interpretation, and which is, you know, how you'll hear the multiverse explained by, you know, a popular science writer like Brian Greene, is essentially that there's an infinite number of parallel realities. So, yeah, therefore, if somebody went back and destroyed a universe, it doesn't destroy every universe. It just destroys that one timeline.
Yeah, essentially, my understanding is it's not true time travel. We're talking about almost parallel universes.
Yeah, exactly. And what's so interesting is, you know, as a student of the John Teeter story, increasingly this has become mainstream science. You open up the New York Times science section, and it's, are we living in a computer simulation? Is this a multiverse? And what we've been, you know, finding out at CERN always just seems to validate what John Teeter was saying. So he was just slightly ahead of the curve. You know, it was just a few years before people in mainstream science really started to embrace this type of thinking. It was still out there on the vanguard. You know, people were writing about this in science fiction for decades, but it wasn't really becoming acceptable scientifically, and it has with each passing year since John has left.
East of the Rockies, Max is in Junction, Texas. Hello, Max.
Hey there. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, sir.
Okay, great. I'm a self-taught physicist. I was wondering, I got like three questions. Okay, I heard you talking about the many worlds theory, which is like the Copenhagen interpretation, but I think we've moved up to the omniverse with Alfred Lamermont Weber now. And I was wondering if he might know if Andy Basiago was going to be president. And that was listening to Ground Zero on 4-4, it was Votives of Time. And there was a guy on there named Marshall Barnes, and he was going to try and use a Tesla cube and go back in time. Those are my three questions.
All right. Well, Mr. Barnes' time device is not dissimilar to my understanding the gentleman at the University of Connecticut. He's a good acquaintance of mine. I should remember his name. It'll come to me. Anyway, it's pretty much in the theoretical stages from what I understand. However, Andrew Bashago, Project Pegasus, Andrew tells a wonderful story, lots of detail. What are your thoughts about Andrew Bashago?
Yeah, I think there's a reason why the John Teeter story is, you know, you can kind of keep kicking at it and won't really budge. But with the Andrew Bashago story, I think, just like you said, it's a lot of fun, but I think, you know, wasn't he supposed to be president? Why is Donald Trump president? I thought it was supposed to be Andrew Bagiego. And some of his claims about, meeting Obama and all this stuff, it's a little out there. Then again, I'm the guy who wrote a book about John Teeter. I remember I was at my in-laws, and they asked me what my most recent book was. And I said, oh, it's a nonfiction book about a time traveler. And they're like, oh, can you explain that one to me?
All right. Professor Ronald Mallett from the University of Connecticut is the other gentleman. These two are sort of in a race, I guess, to build a time travel device. Let's get into a discussion about who the likely the suspects are, who may be behind this whole John Teeter legend. And I want to start with an entertainment lawyer by the name of Larry Haber. Who is he and how is he connected?
So Larry Haber came forward in 2004 claiming to represent Kay Teeter. He published John Teeter, A Time Traveler's Tale.
Sorry, Mike, I just wanted to clarify. You mentioned Kay Teeter. That was a woman who claimed to be John Teeter's mother.
Yes.
Okay, sorry. And
so she wrote some comments in John Teeter, Time Traveler's Tale, which was essentially a collection of his posts. And Larry has also been the primary figure sort of pushing this story forward, because once John left, Larry has uploaded some videos which are supposedly from even more Johns. There was this one video claiming there were two or more Johns, and they needed this video with these coordinates to help them return to their original world lines. So Larry, my friend Dan Scott, he says all roads lead to Larry Haber. If somebody has authored this story, either they've hired Larry Haber, either they're a relative of Larry Haber, or Larry Haber has been unwittingly hired by whoever wrote this story. But I do have an interesting development with Larry Haber. He was recently on the Jimmy Church program, and at the time, this was January 25th, and he said that the family had no longer required his services. And he said that they told him that, I believe he said 8 months ago. And now I'd spoken to Larry Haber, a brief email interview, just 10 days prior, asking him all these questions about John Teeter, and he never mentioned that then. So why the sudden change? And why wouldn't he mention that they had severed services with him when I contacted him? So my theory is there was a recent video by Rasmus, or the Hoax Hunter, implicating a number of Larry's family members. So I think it's possible that it just got, if maybe Larry is, in on this, it just got a little too hot for him, and it wasn't maybe fun anymore, because Larry has essentially, from what he said on Jimmy Church, taken his ball and gone home. So Larry has stepped away. He says the family no longer employs him.
My question, I guess, would be, A, why would a time traveler need the services of an entertainment lawyer? And secondly, the other one would be, if Larry Haber is behind this, what does he know about theoretical physics?
The accusations from Rasmus are that one of Haber's two brothers, either Maury Haber or Richard Haber, may be the true author of the post, because they both have IT backgrounds. So the Hoax Hunter has gone to great lengths to implicate them. Some of it is more convincing, some of it is a little less convincing, but the idea would be that maybe a number of Habers are involved in this together.
All right, we have a gentleman here who says he met John Teeter on the Wild Card Line. Is it Savant in Kansas City?
Yes.
Hi. And did I get the first name correct? Is it Savant?
That's correct. It is Savant.
All right. Welcome.
And I actually met John Teeter back in 1991. I was working. I've been in IT. I'm a director for a supercomputer consortium now. At the time, I was working for a company that was located in Clearwater, Largo, Florida, which is east of Tampa. And I had been working on some IBM gear. We did IBM, Apollo, HP, Sun Microsystems, and actually invented an upgrade for Sun Microsystems servers. But I was taking a break out on one of the ponds behind the property that we had. We were in a shopping center that had several buildings. And this guy just sort of appeared out of nowhere. It just, you know, I didn't see him walk up. It's like he just appeared out of nowhere. And he started asking me if I worked on IBM gear. And I said, yes, I do. And he'd mentioned something about the 5100 and the translator. And I said, I think those are like really old models. The ones that we have do have translators. And you mentioned something about ATL and Unix going back to 1975. I think that's a little predating, you know, Unix is a very strong operating system. But when I got, and the reason that I remember his name is because I wrote it down and I said, I'm going to go talk to somebody. And he said, I don't have much time. And I just thought that was really strange. When I came back, he was gone.
Hmm.
But, you know, we talked for about 15 minutes. The guy looked, he just had that look about, you know, military intelligence. And I know that CENTCOM is in Tampa. I didn't really think anything about it at that point in time because I didn't know who John Teeter was. But I just, after I've heard this and, you know, the many people, I'm John Teeter the second and whatever, that there's so many people that have capitalized on this. But I seriously actually remember talking to this guy for about 15 minutes.
Ah, the plot thickens. Savant, great call. Thanks for checking in from Kansas City. What do you make of that, Mike?
Yeah, it's interesting, and Savant sounds like a pretty credible guy. Maybe, it's, as I was mentioning earlier, that Larry Haber video about how there are all these multiple John Teeters lost on different timelines, maybe one of those John Teeters ended up in 1991.
Well, here's the other question. If Larry Haber is behind it, or his brother Richard Haber, or Maury Haber, they... By all accounts, they haven't cashed in on it. They haven't sold a script to Hollywood. They haven't sold a million copies of a book. They probably could have had they pushed it. So why go to all this trouble?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, and it's what we always come back to, is that, you know, I think Oliver Williams said, you know, if Larry Haber's behind this and trying to make money, he must be the worst entertainment lawyer in the world. So where are... The assumption I always come back to is that if it's a fiction, it may have been done for the sheer love of the storytelling, and it may have been done for the sheer love of the game, essentially. And whoever did it just wanted this thing to remain a mystery. And then, you know, it's like, you know, whenever there's some of these, you know, viral videos that are mysterious, and then, you know, the internet's trying to figure out what they are, and then eventually it's just a promo for a film or something, and then everyone's a little bit let down. And that's what keeps the John Teeter story satisfying to people, is that letdown hasn't come.
Did you ever reach out to the woman claiming to be his mother, Kay Teeter, in Florida?
No. There's no real way to reach her. You can forward questions to her through Larry, but I believe she's not particularly responsive.
Is there an actual Teeter family living in Florida?
Teeter is a pseudonym. He said that all along. And so, you know, whatever his real name is, it's not Teeter. So whatever Kay Teeter's real name is, it's not Teeter. And they actually, I believe they live in Oklahoma, because that was what John believed would be the safest city in the event of the nuclear war that he thought was going to occur. So he shipped his family over there.
And is this pretty much the end of the line then for the story? We don't expect to hear from John Teeter again?
Well, we really don't know. We weren't expecting to hear from John Teeter when that video came out. So my feeling is that the person who's advanced the story has been Larry Haber. So unless he's there to keep putting out John Teeter content, maybe there'll be nothing about no new John Teeter content, but there may be new content implicating different figures. You know, for example, there's little things that happen all the time. Like recently, somebody, Pamela Moore, who interacted with John more than any poster, she had a couple of her friends put a piece of the IBM 5100 logo that he was supposed to have sent her on eBay, and it was selling for $10,000.
All right, I've got to wrap it up here, Mike. Very quickly, how can people get a copy of the book, Who Authored the John Teeter Legend?
Yeah, it's on Amazon, Who Authored the John Teeter Legend by Mike Sauve, S-A-U-V-E. You can also go to my website, www.mikesauve.com.
All right.
My other book's there. The Apocalypse of Lloyd is on there.
Great. Mike, a pleasure. Thank you so much for this.
Okay, thank you.
Here are the Zombies, Care of Cell 44, taking us into the break in Coast to Coast AM.